This is probably the fastest way to do that, so I'll say hello to everyone on behalf of the fishes. And a few years previous to that, a new instructor at Emmaus attended this assembly for a number of years, and I'd like to bring his greetings as well, Mr. Bob Ramey, who has recently joined the faculty at Emmaus. We have fond memories, all of us, as we from time to time think on the happy occasions we had with you all during those years, and I personally appreciate the opportunity to be with you again. When Mr. Rice called up that morning, early one morning, and invited us to come down, I was thrilled, and from that moment on, we were planning on bringing the whole family. And Linda, who was born at Baylor Hospital, was especially anxious to get back and see hometown for her. But a little problem came into existence. The school district in which we live, for some reason or another, doesn't know when Easter falls. And they had their vacation 2 weeks ago, and that makes it a bit difficult in traveling this time of the year. When we had to inform our family of that, little Linda, alas and alack, wept bitter tears. But nonetheless, I bring their greetings as well. Maybe a little bit down the line we'll be able to come down and visit with you as a family. I would like you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Ecclesiastes. I'd like to consider this little book with you this weekend. I have heard it said that a young man begins in the Gospels and then goes on into the epistles to come to a doctrinal understanding and finally returns in his mature years to the Gospels to come to know his Lord of whom the epistles speak. Now, I don't know when we come to Ecclesiastes, and by the time it's taking you to find that book, I expect not many of us have been in Ecclesiastes here of late. Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Now, we will not have time this weekend to look in any great detail at this book. And I'm glad of that in a way, because there are a lot of problems in here that I don't have an answer to, quite frankly, and neither do many people. But at the same time, I think we will be able to get something of the overall emphasis and contribution this book is making to the lives of each one of us. We have a view of inspiration that says all Scripture is profitable. Yet this is one of the, we probably put this 64th or 65th or 66th on the list of books, wouldn't we? It certainly wouldn't be the top 10. We reserve that for Romans and the four Gospels and maybe Acts, certainly Philippians. And lastly, perhaps this book. Now, it has a contribution for us, and that it has been preserved for our study by the Holy Spirit of God under inspiration, first of all, and then superintendence of the collecting of these books. We must assume that it is, in keeping with 2 Timothy 3, profitable for our studies. So let us gain a little bit of profit as we come to this book to see its major contribution to the lives of each one of us. Now, when we don't have time to read a book, we do a number of things. You and I do this. Anybody who's been to school has done something called reading the beginning and the end and skimming in between. Well, let's look at the beginning, let's look at the end, and let's skim a little bit this hour. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, Solomon, the author of this book. Vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. That's very straightforward, isn't it? That gives us a little clue as to what he's going to be talking about. Vanity, vapor. It's gone, here and gone. And he's going to be talking about this throughout the book. This is a reoccurring statement in this book of Ecclesiastes, this concept of vanity and vexation of spirit. So we would assume that he's going to talk about vanity. The things that are vain, the things that are transitory, the things that are mundane and meaningless. Then we turn over to the conclusion of the book, and in verse 8 of chapter 12, he says, vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, all is vanity. This preacher, unlike other preachers, has stuck to his subject. You know, he hasn't wandered all over the barn. He started out vanity of vanities, and he's ending up with the same thing, just to make certain we get that point. Everything's empty. All is vanity. And in this epilogue, he is very kind to us, as good preachers do. He is summarizing what he said in all those 12 chapters that have preceded. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he gave good heed and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find out acceptable words, and that which was written was upright, even words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads and like nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given by one shepherd. And further, by these, my son, be admonished. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. My students use this as a central verse for their life, I think. Let us hear the conclusion. Here's the summary statement. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter, this whole book. I'm going to summarize in one verse. Says the preacher, fear God and keep his commandments. For this is the whole of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Now, as we look at what this author has concluded with in this section, and what he has said throughout this book, we are amazed, on a superficial reading, that this could even be the conclusion. What has his theme been? Vanity, vanity, vanity. And we're going to be looking at various aspects of the vanity that he points out. He goes through various relationships in life, and he says, let's go to intellectual pursuits. What does that give you? Zero. He says, let's go then to mirth and pleasure. What does that give you? Zero. Let us then take another route and go to great building programs, architecture, and all the rest. What does that give you? Zero. Let's go then to the fine arts. Let's get music and dancing and great portraits. And what does that give you? Zero. Let's go to riches. And what does that give you? Zero. We're getting to be a bit monotonous, aren't we? Well, let's try a few more things. Let's try government. What does the political arena give you? Zero. Let's go to position then, prestige, status in life. What does that give you? Zero. Now let's all that up, add that all up, and what does it come to? Zero, plus zero, plus zero, plus zero, plus zero, even in new math, gives you zero. You would expect. But that's not the conclusion he makes. He doesn't make that conclusion. He said, I have looked at all these things, and what is the whole responsibility of man? Fear God and keep his commandments. Now, is he making a mistake? What he has just taught, he calls knowledge in this conclusion. He still taught the people knowledge. Well, is that being a little arrogant to say zero and zero and zero and zero is knowledge? And he goes on to say these are words that should be written and engraven on plaques and mottos in our houses. And they're like nails that you hang on a wall and put a verse on. How many of you have a verse from Ecclesiastes hanging in your house? I've seen lots of verses behind creatures. One like this from Colossians, that in all things he might have the preeminence. We preach Christ crucified. I have not once seen vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Have you? Yet this is what the preacher is saying. And he's saying, that's wise. This is wisdom. Remember it. Now, how can he come to this conclusion that what he has taught is indeed wisdom, when what he has said is zero, 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 zero? That's what life is. How can he say that? He can say this because by engaging in any one of these activities. In pursuing after knowledge, pursuing after pleasure, pursuing after delights, pursuing building programs, pursuing riches, pursuing politics, pursuing any one of these ingredients of life that each one of us function in to one extent or another, will never give us the big picture of life. The author of Ecclesiastes is viewing life in the universe, uni, one, verse, song, one song, and it's all saying one thing. Every aspect of life is saying one thing to us, and it is pointing us to our God. And it is pointing us to that one who will give meaning and delight in any one of the individual things the author of Ecclesiastes is selecting. But any one of those taken by themselves will never, hear it, never bring meaning to life. They will never explain my role in life. They will never answer the question, who am I? They will never account for the vicissitudes of life that each of us find ourselves in our experience. Never by taking one, another, a third. It is rather as we look beyond the under-the-sun experience to the God who holds all this together that we will properly be able to understand any one of these, and that these everyday activities of life, work, our relationship to finances, the home setting, it is only as we look to our God that these will all be brought together, that we will have the big picture of life lived on this earth for the glory of God. You know, we expect too much of the world. And the author of Ecclesiastes is exhorting us to put not great hope in an earthly experience to bring meaning and purpose to our lives. Now, this time remaining, I would like to look at some of these zeros that he has talked about. As Solomon says, let us look at one particular aspect and see if devoting ourselves to one aspect of life brings meaning to life. Now you may say, why do we have to do that? We all know the secret that true life is found in Jesus Christ. We do, and we don't. We know that theory, but that theory is not always a practice in our lives. There are many young people who have not yet made that decision that says, I'm going to live with eternity's values in view. Their brother was mentioning last evening that we are going to say, you are my Savior and you are my Lord. And if the book of Ecclesiastes is going to say anything to us, it is this, that God and acknowledging God's place is the only way that you and I will find any purpose, any delight, and the experience that we find ourselves in here on earth. Let's just look at a few of these zeros. Now, we're looking at them alone now, not together, not bound together by a great God who is directing it all, but alone. We'll look at, first of all, the desire to increase knowledge. Verse 12 of chapter 1. How can I make meaning and purpose out of life? The preacher is saying, let's try education. Let's try wisdom. Verse 12 of chapter 1, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This severe travail hath God given to the sons of man to be exercised therewith. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. Behold, here's this theme, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which is crooked cannot be made straight, and that which is lacking cannot be numbered. I spoke to mine own heart, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and have gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom, and knowledge, and I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is vexation of spirit. Conclusion to his first comment, for in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. Is wisdom is the pursuit of intellectual development? Is the pursuit of knowledge as an end in itself going to bring meaning and a purpose to our lives? Hear it? It will not. It brings grief. And this is spelled out in everyday experience. You say you are going to take training to sell insurance. Good vocation. Now, one of the things you'll have to learn is how to write up the insurance sales, the policies, and the mechanical dimensions of that that any insurance salesman must know. But then you're also going to find out that there's the other end of that, that claims are going to be made. In the case of life insurance, your training is going to open you up to all sorts of sorrows because you are coming into contact with people, either by mail or by direct contact, with people who are bereaved. In case of accident insurance, you have to go to that hospital room and get that release or whatever. And there's a whole multiplied dimension of the sorrow of life that you're exposed to. And the whole courtroom procedure that follows in many cases, again, brings added burdens to your mind. Go another route. Go into training for nursing. Same story. Training for medical doctors. Same story. You'll say, but I don't have those kind of activities that involve human suffering. Go to the garage. One of my main sources of suffering is that automobile. Isn't it yours? Why, certainly it is. And you don't think it's a sorrowful experience to be parked out there with two flaps or one and a car not running, distributor cap cracked and it's raining and the car won't start? And you happen to be a garage man, and the more you know, the more sorrow you know. And this is true in every addition of sorrow, of knowledge that we make to our lives. It opens up a whole new vista of difficulties, of problems. And you know, it doesn't give a solution. It doesn't give a solution. And when we have given ourselves to any field of endeavor, we find out that the answer is not there. The answer to life is not in knowing more and more and more, else all the educated people would be satisfied. And those of us here would be in deep trouble. Dr. Carl accepted. We'd be in trouble, wouldn't we? Intellectual pursuit does not bring satisfaction. In and of itself, it doesn't. Well, Solomon says, let's take a lighter vein. I said in my heart, come now, I will test thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it's mad. And of mirth, what doeth it? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine, not getting drunk, just so I could savor the good taste, is what he's saying. Does pleasure give satisfaction? Last weekend, I had opportunity to be speaking in Lyman, Colorado, and I flew from Chicago on a ski flight to Lyman. Everybody was skiing. It was worth your life to walk through the entranceway with skis and all the rest of it. And I returned late Sunday evening on a DC-10, loaded with a ski flight once again. And they had a pleasurable weekend, indeed. There were broken bones, broken moralities, broken spirits, caused by the imbibing of other forms of spirits. They had a glorious weekend, didn't they? No, they didn't. I met with a few Christians in a farming community, and much the same cross-section of life that we see with us today. Who had the pleasure? Did those hundreds of people on that airplane? Or did that single preacher who happened to be meeting with God's people? Where was their real pleasure, lasting satisfaction? And Solomon is saying that kind of a life that is geared to pleasure, geared to the fulfillment of the lust of the flesh, will not in and of itself bring satisfaction. It will bring zero. Now, young people, don't get sucked in by that. It's an unfortunate thing that we find in evangelical Christianity that great desire to imitate the pleasures of the world, which are fleeting, not real. They are fleeting. We do not go to the nightclub, but we come as close to that as we can with the atmosphere reflected in many a Christian coffee house. We will not take drugs and be sent on psychedelic trips, but we will get the psychedelic lights and the multimedia presentation to have from external sources, those things that are an internal reality for people who have abused themselves by taking drugs. And we so imitate the world, thinking they have the answer to life. And let us not sell our souls for that which can never bring satisfaction and meaning to life. Pleasure in and of itself will not bring purpose and meaning to life. It will not make all of my life hang together. It will leave me frustrated and empty. And the swinging life out there, young people, doesn't have the answer. Those attractive ladies and handsome men get old, and they have to answer then. And let us judge what is meaningful in life by biblical standards, and not try to imitate what we see round about us. It's zero. And this is what Solomon is trying to convince us of. Intellectual pursuits, zero. Pleasure, zero. Well, let's go to something else. Oh, pleasure really doesn't profit people. Let's go to urban renewal. Verse 4. I made for myself great works. I built houses. And he gets involved in architecture. Is this going to bring satisfaction? He makes beautiful monuments, things that are pleasing to the eye. Is that going to do it? He ticks off a number of them very quickly here. Let's go to botany. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruit. I irrigated it. I made pools of water to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. Now, you would think this would bring satisfaction. The only problem is that gets to be a little bit frustrating, too. You know, the rains don't come. And how do you answer that? And then just when the buds are coming forth, for some reason or another, there's a frost, and the fruit is gone. Have you ever heard of that happening in this great state? It happens, doesn't it? Certainly happens up our way. That doesn't give you many answers either. Because the things that you think you can control, you can't control. And the answer to life is not seen. Well, let's turn to the arts. Verse 8, I gathered also silver and gold and the peculiar treasure of kings of the provinces. I got men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men, musical instruments, and that of all sorts. And as Solomon would walk around the splendors of that palace in Jerusalem, there would be the court singers and the small orchestra playing on the various stringed instruments that are written of in the Psalms. Now, I like music, don't you? Very positive thing. And since all of us sing, and I think we reflect God's image in these ways as well, I would assume there's music in heaven. I know there are songs in heaven. Music is good. But in and of itself, it doesn't bring satisfaction. I have some of my children involved in practicing musical instruments. Barbara is trying to learn how to play the piano and the flute. Flute's not bad, piano's not bad. Lois is trying the violin. That's horrible. You know, it's got a... It sounds like they're slaying that cat that has already been slain when she's playing that instrument. Now, some people, I don't think my children ever will because of the limitations set upon them by their inept parents in this regard, but some people say, I'm going to give my whole life to that. 8, 10 hours of practicing the 88 or whatever to master that instrument. That's good. But it's not going to bring satisfaction. The fine arts will not do it. Satisfaction is elsewhere. That by itself will never bring satisfaction. He says it's zero. Well, I'm going to throw myself into my work. I'm going to make meaning out of life by work. Labor will do it. Verse 18 of chapter 2. Yea, I hated all my labor which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. Work like a horse, and we leave it to our son or daughter. And who knoweth, verse 19, whether he shall be a wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have rule over all my labor wherein I have labored, and wherein I have shown myself wise under the sun. This is also vanity. Therefore I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. Do you ever ask yourself the question, why in this world am I working so hard? Can you do anything with it? Does it bring satisfaction to have something? You and I know, both know, that there's that wonderful ability that I think is part of the fall that says, my desire is just beyond what I can attain. It's always that way, isn't it? Just a little more. And we get it, and there's still a little more that we want. The wants never end, normally speaking. And when we accumulate and accumulate and accumulate, it doesn't mean a lick, does it? What good is it all? And just when we can sit down and enjoy it, guess what happens? We die. Isn't that a dirty trick? Isn't that the way life is? Viewed under the sun, viewed in the... We work and work and work and work and retire and die. And leave it to a son or a daughter who may well be a fool and squander the whole business. And he says, I hate my labor. Hate my labor. Well, this is not a very encouraging message, is it? Let's turn to government, chapter 4. Let's get out of myself. This certainly isn't working. I went after mirth. I went after labor. I went after wealth. I went after wisdom. Let's see how things are going out there in the world. Verse 1 of chapter 4. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed. And they had no comforter. And on the side of the oppressors there was power. But they had no comforter. That mournful tune is repeated. Wherefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are yet alive. Yet better is he than both they who have never yet been, who hath not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied by his neighbor. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. He summarizes the world scene as being vanity and vexation of spirit. Isn't that the way it is? They're the oppressed and the oppressors. We do not suffer greatly from that in our country, but you get from our country and other countries of the Western civilization, and you can tick off the countries, and they are a majority of them, in which this is the very scene, this is the situation. the masses of China, the masses of Russia, masses of the communist world and changing nations.
Now turn the tape over.
Chapter 4. So I returned and considered all the oppressions that are done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of the oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. That mournful tune is repeated. Wherefore I praise the dead who are already dead, more than the living who are yet alive. Yet better is he than both they who have never yet been, who have not seen the evil work that is done under the sun. Again, I considered all travail and every right work, that for this a man is envied by his neighbor. This is also vanity and vexation of spirit. He summarizes the world seen as being vanity and vexation of spirit. Isn't that the way it is? There are the oppressed and the oppressors. We do not suffer greatly from that in our country, but you get from our country and other countries of the Western civilization, and you can tick off the countries, and they are a majority of them, in which this is the very scene, this is the situation. The masses of China, masses of Russia, masses of the communist world and changing nations, we see that there is this constant striving and driving after power, and it will change from one hand to the next. And whenever it changes, what is changing is this: the oppressed are becoming the oppressors. And that is the way of mankind. And we should expect that, and we should expect that to some degree in our own governments. And I think we are a little more aware of that now than we have been in past years. The oppressed and the oppressors. Government doesn't bring it. Position, will that do it? Verse 13 of chapter 4. Better is a poor and wise child than an old and foolish king. Oh, if I were to be king, that will bring satisfaction. And this man who was a king said, no, it won't. No. Better to be poor and wise than to be a king. For out of prison a person will come to reign. There will be this overthrow of government, and that foolish king will be thrown down to the depths of degradation. And position is transitory. It's like a vapor. We have not talked about riches. The author of Ecclesiastes is well aware of that. Verse 10 of chapter 5. Satisfaction in riches? He that loveth silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loveth abundance with increase. This also is vanity. Verse 12. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the abundance of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. The picture is this, that man comes home who has worked, and he's physically exhausted, his head hits the pillow, and he's asleep. My wife stayed up for me last Sunday. I came in at about 1 a.m. She was waiting for me. I came in, said a few words to her, stretched out, and I was snoring. She's still awake. That irritated her for some reason or another. I can't understand it. Fighting sleep for all those hours, and then dear husband comes home, it's that fast. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet. But that rich man, and the picture of this rich man here, is that man who has wined and dined. He's had all the rich diet, and now he's trying to go to sleep, and there's a churning in his stomach. Have you experienced that? I surely have. You can see that. And you toss and turn and go for the Alka-Seltzer or the Tums for the Tummies or whatever to take care of that problem. It's the rich diet that does that. The rich man can't sleep. He can't sleep for other reasons quite frequently. All his thoughts of the business. Did I figure that contract right? Did I count all the bricks or did I leave out a wall? You know. And he can't sleep. And that other poor soul that we think has the short end of the stick, boy, he's found out. And the riches won't bring satisfaction either. None of these things in and of themselves will bring satisfaction. It will not give us the big picture of why am I here? What is the purpose of life? Is there meaning to life? None of them by themselves. Well, how in the wide world can this man at the close say, I have taught them knowledge, when all he's done is say, zero, 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 zero. Now live that way. Well, as we look at this same book tomorrow afternoon, we will see that he has another viewpoint that goes throughout this book that takes those very same individual things and says, if you live this way in these spheres, then life will hang together and you will walk hand in hand with your God and life will be a joy to experience. Tomorrow we'll look at that in the will of God.